I'm Inga Mewburn, a professor at the Australian National University and editor of the Thesis Whisperer blog. Welcome to episode 4 of Academics Talk About the Chair. This podcast series is a lockdown project because, well, why not? We all watch the vaccine scoreboard daily, waiting for the magic 80% threshold to be reached. And I'm pleased to report that Canberra's winning this particular race right now, but Sydney and Melbourne are excited because they're now allowed to have picnics outside with people who aren't their cellmates, sorry, family. During lockdown, we're all watching a lot of Netflix. In particular, we've been watching a new Netflix series called The Chair, one of the only shows to ever attempt to depict contemporary academic life on the small screen. But what do academics think? We are 4 white female academics and we loved it. We have all the thoughts and feelings about The Chair and we want to share them with you. We'll do a recap complete with spoilers and then we'll talk about what's real, what's not, who had the best line and most importantly, the outfits. But first of all, some introductions.
Hi, I'm Narelle Lemon. I'm an Associate Professor in Education at Swinburne University of Technology. I'm an interdisciplinary scholar across arts, education and positive psychology, and I blog and write about well-being and self-care at exploreandcreateco.com. And I subscribe to Netflix to watch this series. It's true. It really is.
And I'm Megan McPherson, and I'm precariously employed artist researcher and educator in art and intercultural research. And I work at the University of Melbourne.
And hi, I'm Anicha. I'm the ex-co-chair of the School of Graphic Design at an art and design university in San Francisco. And I'm now head of course design at RMIT Online. I sound exactly like Inga because I'm her identical twin sister. We've talked about this a few times now if you've listened to some of the other episodes. My story about our voices being the same today is brought to you by my boss, who listened to the podcast and texted me to say that he can tell my voice apart from Inga's because he's had over a year's worth of exclusively listening to me talk over Zoom. And look, the poor man has had to listen to me a lot and probably way too closely. So that might be actually true, Inga. I'm just going to go with that.
So as you can tell, none of us are film studies academics. So don't expect a deep, informed analysis grounded in the literature. But wait, this week we are joined, very excitingly, by a fandom scholar expert, Dr. Bertha Chin, a senior lecturer from Swinburne University of Technology in Sarawak in Malaysian Borneo. Welcome in, Bertha.
Hi.
Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Hello. Thank you for having me here. And it's a real pleasure to be here to be talking about The Chair, which I loved, and little known fact, perhaps. One of my inspirations for going into a PhD program back in the day was because of David Duchovny, and The X-Files was a huge part of my PhD thesis, so expect to hear a lot about that, I think, in the coming
Okay, we're going to need to hear about that, Bertha. That's amazing.
I mean, we're so pleased that you could join us for 2 episodes, so you'll get the lead up to David Duchovny and the actual appearance of David Duchovny. So thanks so much for joining us, Bertha. I might add also increasing the diversity and representation in our podcast. So we're no longer just 4 white women. We now have a woman of colour. Thank you for helping us out with that. Okay, we're taking our cue here from projects like Doctors Watch Grey's Anatomy, where we compare our experience and knowledge of how a profession works with a fictional account on the screen. We're located in Australia and today also in Malaysia, and we've all done various jobs inside academia, but of course we can't claim to have experienced everything. This is our point of view and we want to hear others. We're dreaming of other people doing more podcasts and writing about The Chair, and we share that with you in our correspondence section. Okay, so first of all, we're going to do an episode recap, and this week Narelle is doing the recap duties. Take it away, Narelle.
So today we're talking about the episode called Don't Kill Bill. And so we open the scene with Bill sitting on his front step in his tartan PJs and jacket on. His hair's less rugged than usual and a car approaches. It's Ji Yoon. She arrives in her ace duffel jacket, but she's pretty stern. Temporary suspension, she says. Bill asks about his classes. He's not allowed on campus. What? And insert a mega rant from Bill. And then he asks, did you defend me? Ji Yoon's arms fly out of her jacket. She's not happy. This is not what I want to be dealing with as a chair. The frustration is playing out and the politics is very much present. There is a discussion about what to do next. Ji Yoon calls Bill a dumbass, which I'm pretty sure right now Megan is yelling at the screen, saying, about time. And plans for an apology are made. There's a disciplinary hearing to be scheduled. Juju's ghoul calls, and you hear Ji-Yoon saying, hit or bite. So it's been an adventurous morning at school.
Every parent's had that call.
And we cue in the typesetting and music. So we open back in Ji-Yoon's kitchen. She's standing at the island bench and she's wearing a dapper jacket, and the collar once again is flipped up. It's over an auburn orange jumper and a white collar. She always rocks the white collar. Mm. Like, she's got this thing about collars in her costumes. It's always amazing. Mm. And she's staring at Bill and Juju. You are both suspended. Cute face is being pulled, Juju playing with her lips, and Bill looking down with a slip-bottom lip whimper, like little boy he is. Ji-Yoon instructs letters to be written, apologies, and there's mega sighs all round in the room. Back on campus, Joan finishes up a lecture telling her students not to be slackers. In comes Horatio, the IT dude in his puffer jacket, which is over his shirt hanging out, and his denim faded jeans. He's got a pep in his step. I've been able to do that thing you talked about, he says. Joan declares, I didn't think you were really going to do it. I was only joking. I've hacked into your professor.com, declares Horatio. Joan has a mini heart attack about being associated with something illegal, but progresses further as she finds out where the student is posting from. It's the humanities library. Plans are made to hunt this student down. And there's a bit of a touching moment between Horatio and Joan with the eye connection, and I'm like, love is in the air. Meanwhile, Lila, who's Bill's TA, is walking across campus, backpack on, and she's looking schmick, as she always does. She's approached by a journalist, Charlotte Law, from the Pembroke Daily. No comment. Sorry. Repeats multiple times, but is caught out. I can't answer, okay? The chair has given me an earful about talking to anyone about this. And we watch the journalist click save on her phone. She's recorded a scoop. Back at Ji-Yoon's house, Billy's babysitting Juju. She doesn't cook, is Juju's commentary on Bill for Bill when he opens the fridge to find stacks of packed food and meals with some oat milk and eggs. I don't eat eggs, she claims. And Bill's like, because you don't like them or you've not tried them. I'll give you $1 if you try a bite. And Juju replies with, well, name one thing you can buy with $1. And Bill comes back with, well, raisins. Nailed. And Juju has the mega eye roll.
She's great at the eye roll.
I love the eye rolls.
Kids and raisins. My kids won't eat them at all anymore. That's why, right? She nailed it.
I think it traumatizes them. You give them to them because when they're little, they really think it's like candy, and then they cop
them. Yeah, they do. Buggers.
Yeah.
So back on campus, Ji-Yoon has a visit from two students. They're seeking clarification about the institution poli side and them not granting a tenure to the only person of colour. Assholes, calls Ji-Yoon under her breath. We're worried about what will happen to Professor McKay, a.k.a. Yaz. And they list in zest the issues, you know, not being held accountable by the same standards, research isn't considered as rigorous, they assume to be less organised, less collegial, invited less often to their colleague's house for dinner. And Ji-Yoon comments that, trust me, I know. And right now you have that, oh, my heart, you know, you're really feeling it in terms of this discussion and the pressure of Ji-Yoon, what's happening and what the students are saying, all those perspectives going on. And the students hand over a letter signed by 320 students highlighting the impact she's had on them. And they leave the office declaring that if she's denied tenure, they're going to take action. And they're really super serious at the moment. Ji-Yoon heads over to Elliot's office. Don't you look dashing, she comments as he wears his robes. There's a bit of collegial banter, leadership connection, and we can see that they know each other well. There's a lot of respect, and we just smell the hint of, oh no, I have to do this. I have to talk about Yaz's tenure and his attitude. So she's offering him a new robe, and he's like, well, thanks, kiddo. And they have a discussion about highlighting her teaching. This is Yaz's teaching, her pedagogy, her flipped classroom. She believes that some of this will be on display in today's session. Elliot is disengaged. He looks so bored at this moment, and I'm secretly infuriated, and I just want to grab his shoulders and shake them at this moment. Jiyun is sharing how shit-hot Yaz is. She's got over 8,000 followers on Twitter, but Elliot's just not impressed. He compares that to cult activists. He's really dismissive. Jiyun becomes really frustrated. I don't want to pull rank here. It's the right thing to do for the department, for Yaz. Just do it. We meet up with Joan. He's on the staircase texting Horatio for plans to meet in the library. She's glowing. Should we come incognito is her last text. Then from nowhere, we have this old white man in his cardi and shades of grey slap a rolled up newspaper on Joan's ass. You've still got a top-notch rear end. And she replies, wish I could say the same for you. Yaz is in her class. Yaz leads animated discussions about Melville and Moby Dick with Elliot looking on with a stern look on his face. There's shock, he's uncomfortable. And we've got rap, hip-hop, poetry, music, laughing, clapping, and engagement 101 is happening. It is amazing and awesome, and I just want to be in that class. Mm. And Jazz has the classroom that, you know, I really wanted to be a part of as a student as I'm watching this, and you can see the students so engaged. Mm-hmm. We flash to now, and they're writing each other's apology letters, of course, as you do. And we hear them read them out loud in the lounge room. The history of Juju's real name, Yuhi, is shared, and we hear of the connection to Ji-Yoon's mother. Juju is not a fan of the name, and we talk about prosperity versus posterior, two very key terms. Next scene, we see a spread of David Duchovny photos. We're talking about marketing now. It looks like a spread from a magazine we'd seen in Doctor's Surgery or The Hairdresser. There's sultry looks, the shirt is unbuttoned, and it's sex on a page. We're hiring to sell cognac, shares Jiyun. She's not impressed, and she's expected to read his work and then help him teach Bill's class. Jiyun gets a lecture about taking her role more seriously, and we hear the words, you are the chair, you are not a peer, you are not Bill's peer. And side note, this had me rocking in the corner. I didn't like that interaction at all. Bill and Jiyun are in the kitchen now, and they're talking about babysitting. And Bill's eager to continue. Jiyun clearly grappling with the professional, personal, not a peer tensions here. And Bill makes Jiyun food. Hands over fish with squeezed lemon, lovingly adding some herbs on top. And Juju wakes up wandering out in a Pembroke oversized t-shirt. Why did you go? She says. Can you come? Sure, says Jiyun. No. Bill. Mm-hmm. And at that moment, it's so sad.
Juju.
Oh, no. Bill carries her to bed. There's lots of cuddles. And she's asking, can you finish the story? That evening, Elliot is in bed reading papers on Yaz and her tenure and talking to his wife about Yaz and that she doesn't seem to want to teach them, that she just wants to hang out with them. Elliot begins to judge her application. He compares the application to his wife. And side note here, she didn't get tenure because she was expected to write a book, but she was busy raising three kids.
And what was he doing?
I know.
They're getting tenure, obviously. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. All right. I won't take it off track. Yeah. Go on. Carry on.
Elliot ignores the irony of this, declaring she was the best that they had. He apologizes he didn't put more pressure on them. And she responds back, should have, would have, someone had to make the dinner.
True.
There, I think, is your answer. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But what I love next is that she hands him some diapers. And Elliot, you know, has to come to terms with that he's getting older and his body's aging. And we have this little moment here where it's a bit of reality call.
It's quite sweet, that
I moment, thought actually. Elliot might be about to start a journey. This is the moment where I'm like, oh, maybe there's somewhere for Elliot to go. But anyway,
Bill is in the kitchen with fresh veggies and he's helping Juju with her homework. Boppy music, multiple scenes are shared with us on the life they're having together. He even has his hair done by Juju. Bill's helping her with the assignment on being a cultural ambassador. He's a bit more into it than her, and she declares, when is it recess? as she face plants into the kitchen island bench, and then she motions like snow angels with her arms. And is it this moment where you just go, I love this actress. She's so good. Jane enters with the dramatic sliding of the elevator doors. She's dressed in what I would say is the best outfit for today. She's rocking her disguise. Cue the oversized shades, a scarf covering her head in all shades of tan and burgundy. The music playing in the background is Paris Summer by Nancy Sinatra and Lee Hazelwood, a.k.a. 1972. And I shazammed this.
That would have been her heyday, right?
I reckon. And we feel like we're walking into a Western standoff, but it's the library. And Horatio is sitting at the desk with shelves of books surrounding him. She sits down, picks up a book and says, it's me. Because, you know, her disguise for the undercover job is she's just rocking it. Horatio is all set up for the ratemyprofessor.com key moment. It's the showdown. Horatio picks up a book to read. You're reading Chaucer, she says. They enter into this comparison of letting it go as you read to understand. Like coding, he says. Ding, a message is posted. The hag makes me want to kill myself. They get close. He's here, he's here. They're on the hunt. And Joan, in her awkwardness, fumbles putting on her big shades and immediately goes on to the hunt into the library. Horatio runs after. We flash to Elliot struggling with the photocopier. He's got one of the best one-liners with this one here. And he talks about how, well, I can't make copies, but I think I've just unlocked my car. Yaz approaches, giggles, offers to help, and weaves magic. They bond over the misspelled words in the death notice of Melville. He says thanks, walks off, but he leaves the original in the copier. As Jazz notices it, picks it up and yells out, she also takes a glimpse of what he's copying. She's shattered. Bill is playing outside with Juju. Water balloons, of course. For a lesson in physics and air resistance. And, well, this can only go where only Juju can take it. She throws and it explodes on him first off. She runs, she giggles. She giggles like a little girl. And this is the first time we really, really hear her being her age. And it's quite touching. And so she runs off and Bill's chasing, and they enter the campus, of which Bill is not allowed to be. Back in the library, Joan is hunting down every male student. She gives one a lesson on no sleeping in the library, then spots the evaluations poster. She yells out, hey, but he's wearing earphones. And he's just casually walking through the library. She runs chasing him, Horatio following. They have this awkward moment at the censors, setting it off and nearly taking it out. The student, meanwhile, is just walking at his cool pace, earphones in with beanie and leather satchel over his shoulder. Outside, he turns around. Steve! Professor Hatley! Now you listen to me. And she goes into this rant at him about philandering husbands, horny wives, farting, shitting, pubic hair, and celebrating the great authors and literature. And Steve just walks off with this look on his face with, oh, like, good one, old lady. But there's four other students looking on and they're cheering and they're like, all right, what are you lecturing? Yaz, meanwhile, is walking down the stairs with the grand stained glass features surrounding the halls to find Ji-Yoon unwrapping a big poster board announcing the distinguished lecture. She's pissed. In Ji-Yoon's office now, Ji-Yoon is reading the paper from the photocopier. I'll ask him to pull back. It's just a draft. Yaz replies, he's making copies on letterhead. And so this is that tense moment between mentor and mentee, and all the feels here are for Jazz. She doesn't have the support for tenure promotion and how relations in academia can change and what is normalized and what is not and what is assumed, expected and inferred. And it kind of speaks a lot to Ji-Yoon as well and her role as the chair, as peer and what's happening. Yaz raises at Ji-Yoon she's not sure about what she should say anymore, and so they have this tense moment here in terms of what their relationship's about. And she's reminded that you have tenure and that you're now chair, and I'm not sure what I can say. They discuss visions and alignment and also David Duchovny. The boundaries here and how they are fluid and often, and actually most of the time not spoken about, are really accurately captured. And Ji-Yoon shares that she feels like she's been handed a ticking time bomb rather than a place where she can put her vision into action. And this part of the conversation also resonates with me. Told you have an opportunity, but you really don't. They discuss institutional power, insecurity, and feeling sorry for colleagues, namely Elliot in this situation. And Yez says, yeah, I can see why you feel so sorry for him. He only got to rule the profession for the last 40 years.
Man.
And it's so powerful and goosebumps every time I watch that scene. Juju runs onto campus. Bill's still chasing her. She's giggling. She's still giggling. And Bill yells at her, a bit sternly now, I'm serious. And cue the songs, Decepticon by La Tegra. And gosh, the soundtracks are awesome. It's the perfect song for this moment, as this chase moment. So the chase is interrupted, but it's with this white student in a navy blazer, burgundy university cap on, tan chinos. Hey, Dobson, don't back down. Free speech to America, he yells out.
Is he meant to be a MAGA dude?
Yeah, like that's like Turning Point, which is the on-campus right-wing organization. They're full of guys like that. And some of them go to colleges like that just so that they can, you know, mix it up.
Ji-Yoon's in Bill's office. She looks with compassion at a photo of Bill and Sharon embraced in a hug. The dean, meanwhile, is reading a book in his office, Truly Like Lightning by David Duchovny. I had to freeze it and try and figure out what it was he was reading, and then I discovered and Googled. And it was released in February 2021, so this year, and it's a New York bestseller. And it's noted as an epic adventure that asks how we make sense of right and wrong in a world of extremes. And side note, it's rated 3.9 out of 5 on Goodreads.
Bertha, have you read it?
I haven't. I've got his first book, but, not the others. Not yet.
I need to hear about the first book.
Bang! A water balloon smashes on the dean's window. He stands up, goes to the window, and we see Juju running off in her pink jacket and beanie. The song Decepticon by La Tegra is still playing as Bill bursts into the building looking for Juju. We're bopping in our seats, and the music is so perfect for this representation of fast-paced chaos. He pauses at the poster board of David Duchovny. White t-shirt, denim jeans, and a pout you'd see on the front of a pop culture magazine. But Ji-Yoon's still in his office looking for teaching notes. Bill's running through the corridor, swinging off door frames. And side note, he's wearing a Joy Division Unknown Pleasures white on black slim fit t-shirt here. And this was, you know, a debut album by the English rock band Joy Division. And it was released on the 15th of June, 1979. And the image is this stacked plot of radio emissions given out by a pulsar and a rotating neutron star. So Bill finds his office door open. Ji-Yoon is about to leave. Bang, door crashes open. Music stops. Ji-Yoon jumps. Oh, my God, you scared me. What are you doing here? She shuffles him in, closes the door. Both are panting. Those are my lecture notes. Yep, she explains that Dean Larson asked David Duchovny to cover her teaching. What? Bill loses it, not believing that Ji-Yoon is taking my fucking stolen lecture notes to David Duchovny's house. And so they have this little scratch match going on. He snatches them, throws them back on his desk, and they wrestle for the notes, arguing. Then reality of Juju missing hits. Juju's outside. She's giggling and she's walking on this balancing beam, and then we flash back and we realise that it happens to be concrete bollards, which are, it looks like to be about two levels plus up, and there's quite a deep fall. And so she waves and says hi. They panic, calling her off. She's oblivious. I want to jump. I want to jump to Bill. Okay, 1, 2, 3. Juju jumps into Bill's arm. Ji-Yoon wants to go. Come on. Come to dinner, she squeals. And they have this discussion as they're walking to the car. As they walk to the car, Juju's on Bill's shoulders. It looks like a sweet family image. We've got Cemetery Gates, the 2008 remasters version by the Smiths playing. And it's a dreaded sunny day, a dreaded sunny day. So I meet you at the Cemetery Gates and Dean Larson is watching from afar. Dot, dot, dot.
Thank you, Narelle, for your recap. Amazing recap, very detailed. I'm loving the things that you're paying attention to there, and I will pick up on many of them, I think, in our discussion now. So first of all, I just want short episode reaction from each of you, starting with you, Megan.
I still hate Bill.
Okay. How about you, Anitra?
Well, the Joy Division shirt in this episode is like everything I both love and hate about Bill. Like, it's such a signifier for a certain kind of Gen Xer, of which I happen to be one, which I would say sure. is the sort that likes John Cusack movies, basically. And it was in this episode that I texted you, Inga, and said, I would have been so in love with Bill as a professor. What's wrong with me?
We agreed it was our internalized misogyny and we needed to get
yeah,
it.
Yeah, we right. did, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. How about you, Bertha?
I think, you know, a lot of the things that happened in the episode really resonated with me, but I think aside from the possibility of seeing David Coveney on screen, because they didn't really say that he was going to appear. It was just more like a tease that, so I thought, you know, it was just going to be a mention and you're not going to see him again. And I hadn't heard anything, you know, from the fans about him appearing. In fact, no one knew. And I checked with everyone. Not so much Bill, which was good because like Megan, I can't stand him. And lots of scenes with Juju, which I love. So, you know, it's plus and minuses.
Yeah, I did. I also really love the relationship building between Bill and Juju here, which I think also feeds into my theory that she's his morality object. She's there to demonstrate in part that Bill's worth having as a sort of father, husband, boyfriend type of material. But I also really like the way that this episode build relationships between Joan and Horatio. Like, everyone's relationships were being sort of built and tested and challenged in this one. I thought it was great. Let's dig a little deeper, team. So what was the most realistic scene and what do you think it accurately captured or critiqued about academic life? Scene or scenes? Bertha, you first.
What particularly resonated was, I think, really early on in the episode when the two students actually burst into her office and then started telling June about how women of color or scholars of color in this instance, you know, are assumed to be less collegial, have less opportunity for tenure. I think it seemed like they were lecturing her about systemic racism. And I just thought, oh, my God, you know, I have been there. Exactly, having people lecture me about, you don't know anything about systemic racism. And I'm sitting there going, have you seen how I look like? You know, I've been there. So, you know, that really kind of resonated with me. And especially when she said, trust me, I know. Just those four words, it was just something that took me back to a lot of, I think, experiences throughout academia. And the sense that I think also Bill's TA was somewhat pressured to admit that Bill is problematic without probably taking into consideration her position. Because she's a grad student, she's a TA, and obviously she's got less power than a lot of the tenured academics that we're seeing on the show. So I think the journalist was sort of pressuring her, you know, what is your reason for signing up to work with this particular, you know, rock star kind of academic. And I felt it was just putting her in a very disadvantaged position. And I don't think anyone sort of paid attention to the fact that she, at the end of the day, she's probably going to be the one who will be disadvantaged if she said anything. Even if Jiyoon didn't say that, oh, you know, don't talk to the press. And if she did, it was going to affect her entire career. And I don't think anyone talked about that or thought about it from her perspective.
I think you're so right on that, especially the way that academics are often reluctant to speak to journalists for exactly the kind of reason that we see here. Mm. You're just worried about being in the gotcha moment, for sure. How about you, Megan?
I really enjoyed Joan's scene outside the library where she's dressing down Steve about how cool Chaucer is. And I really like the passion because I know that all of us have that passion and it comes out in the most, you know, unusual ways, i.e. Anitra's type nerdery. Inga and your particular nerderies, Narelle. We all have that, you know, little nerd going on. And the other scene is when Yaz is teaching and we have multiple cuts to Elliot's face trying to understand what's happening in front of him. It's just like, oh, mate. You just don't get it.
I know. I thought that was really well done, didn't you? Mm. So many complex emotions on his face. Like, I'm confused. I'm horrified. I'm sad. I don't know who I am in this moment. And also it's just his isolation, the way he's sitting across the other side of the lecture theatre, and he's just so cut off from it all.
This is where I thought he was going to have a journey. I'm like, you know, things are happening to Elliot, but sadly, spoiler alert, not really. Like,
he never really goes anywhere.
But that's a moment for him.
It's his end.
You know? Yeah, it is. Yeah, you're right. You're right.
How about you, Anita?
I think I mentioned the conversation with Yaz that Ji-Yoon has in this episode, in the first episode, like when we started to see the kind of emotional work that she's expected to do. So she's desperately trying to keep a very talented faculty member. She really doesn't have a lot to entice her with because, you know, we don't teach for money. We don't. And once the love's gone, it's hard to hold someone. And, like, I think Ji-Yoon knows she's going to lose this one. And also, I was thinking about it a bit more in this episode, like, how shit is it that a smaller institution, you know, nurtures a talent, okay, all right, imperfectly, all right, but has promoted Yaz to a position where she can be the teacher that she is, and then a bigger institution can just come along and poach. And, like, do they nurture people in the same way? I don't know. And just how formidable reputation is, and how do you say no to Yale? Like, she's not going to win against Yale. That's just not going to happen, right? That's why she's so panicked about it. So, and Inga, you know all about that, right? Like, when the ANU came calling for you, are you going to say no?
Oh, yeah, I walked in. Yeah, I walked into my boss and I said, so ANU's offered me a job, and she's like, okay, then I'm not even going to try.
Like, basically. It's a 900-pound gorilla. Yeah, it was just really interesting. It just seemed to really sort of be quite realistic. I think that happens a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. I wonder how all of you felt about the Dean's really bullshit comparison of David Duchovny covering for Bill, like when you were on maternity leave. For me, that was really quite triggering because it took me back to the time when, you know what daycare's like. Well, maybe you do or you don't know what daycare's like, listener, but you've got to be ready to give them your kid when they want your kid. Like, you've got your time limits and all that kind of stuff. And there were just some times where I couldn't put him in there before 12:30 and I had to take him with me and sit at the desk with him waiting for the daycare window to open, basically. And the male academics that would come in and say, why are you here with your kid? Why aren't you home with your kid? If you want to be with your kid, stay home, one of them said to me. Oh, well, my wife stayed home. You know, she gave up her career. And so what are you doing here? And I don't know. And also the casual smacking of Joan's ass on the way up the stairs, even though she's got a great comeback. It's just like you just wonder how much that's happened to Joan throughout her life. Did you have any further thoughts, Narelle?
Yaz is teaching and the engagement with the students and the questioning and being on the physical same level rather than being at the podium and the movement around the room. And I think that just celebrates so much of learning and teaching, particularly the contemporary learning and teaching pedagogical decisions and innovations and, you know, how that was just so juxtaposed to Elliot with his more traditional teaching at, you know, he's talking at. But I think also there's those tensions of threat, you know, we're supposed to do it. It's the newness. The chair loves it. We are learning from each other. But you've got those, you know, all familiar tensions that we see, experience, watch in higher education.
Yeah, absolutely. And she literally gives the stage to the students, doesn't she?
She does. I mean,
she goes that far, and that's what he just can't get his head around at all. All right, let's move on to unpicking the most unrealistic details or scenes. I'm interested in what you thought was unrealistic and also whether you wish it could be true. So what about you, Megan?
I loved the Lunchables in the fridge, but why are there eggs in there? Because Ji-Yoon doesn't cook.
Continuity error. They should have had you in there, Megan. How about you, Bertha?
Juju's comment about how Ji-Yoon doesn't cook and that scene, you know, where was it processed cheese that you see in the fridge? And that was, I don't know, it was a little bit unrealistic to me, and it seemed more like a critique that, you know, the media always seem to kind of present women in a certain way, especially kind of professional women. You can choose to be really great at your job, but you really suck at everything else. And I thought, you know, for a series that was doing so well in a lot of representation about what is real, you then get to this, the home life. It just seemed like, you have to sacrifice at the end. And I wish they could have done it a little bit better, that, you know, there was a little bit of a more balanced in a sense. So, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What did you, can I put you on the spot and ask you about the representations of David Duchovny that we see on the pictures? You know, there's lots of pictures of him. Did you want to comment on any of those representations of David Duchovny? I think there's a line in here, something about he's selling cognac or something. did he actually do ads?
I don't recall him doing any of the cognac ads. I just, when I saw that, I just thought it was a, you know, it looked like one of those photo shoots from his X-Files days because of the hair. It's really old. Probably from like the mid-90s. And I just thought, okay, I wouldn't have gone with that.
Yeah, Mrs. Whitehead was the one. I think she'd chosen some of the pictures or something. So she's still crushing on his 90s version, maybe. So I was going to ask you to tell us about his first book.
I didn't get a chance to read it.
Did you just buy it?
I'm one of those kind of readers who collect a lot of books and then found, gosh, I have no time to read. So it's actually still sitting in the shelf, and I'll tell myself one day I'll get to this one day. And he's written, what is it, 5 books now, and I'm like, fuck, can we curse on a podcast? Stop writing so fast.
Prolific, Dave. Hey, do you reckon between this week and the next you'll be able to read like maybe the first chapter of the first book and give us a report back?
It's very American. That's what I find. Like it really reminded me of the sort of great American novel, you know. So, and I need to be in the sort of headspace to be able to kind of read them. So it's like it's a lot of references to very 1960s, because the first book was a lot of nostalgia to the 1960s kind of American culture, and it takes a lot for me to get back into that sort of headspace. So, which is probably one. I think the first few books was really kind of set in the sort of 1960s, 1970s. Very kind of, I'm trying to think of the name of the book, which I should probably Google, but it's like the great American novel about coming of age.
Oh, Catcher in the Rye.
Yes. Thanks, Inga.
I haven't read it either, but I did see this movie with Sigourney Weaver in it about the publisher of Catcher in the Rye called... My Salinger days or something.
Yeah,
it's a really good film.
I'm actually an English Lit minor, so you know I've kind of forgotten about all of those literature sort of moments.
Yeah,
jettisoned.
Understandable.
Yeah,
no judgment.
Is one ever really? I mean, in a pandemic, is one ever in the mood for literature? Really?
Exactly.
I mean, come on. Yeah,
it's hard.
All right, Anitra.
Yeah,
Anitra.
What so did unrealistic. You think? Look, this might be a controversial opinion. Okay, but I found Yaz's assessment to be the most unrealistic.
the assessment the students were doing.
Like, it's a really brave choice, but I couldn't help thinking, would that meet the CLOs for this course?
You might want to explain what course a CLO learning outcomes, is for the audience.
Course learning outcomes, which are like guiding sort of statements, frameworks for a course.
Mm-hmm. You just need a very nicely aligned rubric, okay? You'll be right.
Your faith in rubrics.
I just wonder whether we'd really stand up to a Texas audit. But then again, do they look that deeply? I don't know, questions. And then I thought, how are we going to translate that to online, though?
Video presentations.
You make video
presentations.
It's not the same as being in the room, though. What made it work, and you could tell, was the affect in the room and, like, do you capture that on a CLO? And then I was like, I've got to stop trying to problem solve when I watch this show. Like, this is not my problem to solve. Stop it. You know what I mean? And I don't think I've experienced a teacher like Yaz. I've had teachers that are as enthusiastic as that, but I don't think they were ever empowered to do assessments like that, right? So I want it to be true. I want them to be that engaging and effective. Like, these students would never forget whatever it was that she was trying to get them to understand, which is obviously the themes in the book, I think. But it's obvious what a loss she's going to be, and it's a smart choice to contrast it when you can see the forces and the gatekeepers and Elliot's face and how he just doesn't get it. And it just feels very unfair because you're like, well, the students are going to miss out now too. And that's realistic. But, yeah, I don't know. That just, like I said, controversial opinion.
Controversial. All right. No, no, we're here for, we're a broad church of opinions right. here at academics.
And just, you know,
talk about the chair.
You want Megan to be doing your academic governance and compliance, clearly, because she's going to find a way to make sure that Yaz can do that assessment. Oh, yeah. And I love you for that, Megan. I just want to say that right now.
Well, I just want to say that art school, none of the students will do the same thing at any time. So
well, that's
you
true.
Have to be prepared to do your assessments.
We can with just do a
agility.
Whole thing on. True. We could do a whole thing on
rubrics.
What do rubrics capture and not capture? We could do a whole thing on that, Megan. Maybe we could do a spin off podcast on that because that's a lot.
Okay.
Yeah.
By a sidebar, I actually gave a presentation to the TEXA people. You know, I gave them a presentation about how the PhD does and doesn't align to higher education standards framework or something. And I thought, oh, maybe six of them will turn up. It was like lunchtime seminar for them, like not compulsory. There were 40 people there, and I've never had so much intense questioning about governance issues. And Megan, I did wish you were there.
Well,
can I just say?
You know, that's our nerdery coming out. You know, that's academic policy nerdery in itself, where, you know, 40 people want to come and be nerds together.
I know, that was so nerdy. I loved it. I thought it was great, but also tiny bit confronting and to be put on the spot like that. I suppose the thing I thought was unrealistic in this, as funny as it was, Jane and Horatio tracking down that student who gave her the bad review and then chasing after him and yelling at him about it, it's total and pure wish fulfillment for me. I do wish that moment was true, because who hasn't had a student say something that's hurt you or misunderstood what you were trying to do? And I really also had a moment with Joan. It's like she's not as boring as Elliot, but she's kind of in an Elliot mode. And when we see her unplugged and we see that authenticity and that passion, the students really respond to it. Like, what are you teaching next semester? You know, Chaucer. So you just sort of want Joan to be Joan, you know, at that moment. Anyway, team, let's move on to what's the funniest scene or perhaps the most touching scene or both. You can choose. So, Megan, you go first.
I love the apologies that Bill and Juju wrote for each other. And, like, I still hate Bill. But a colleague, and thanks, sure. Ash, suggested that I was doing some Bill accountability rather than Bill hate. Okay, so, you know, maybe that's my my reframing of my hate is actually Bill accountability. Bill accountability.
Anita, your turn. What was the funniest scene or the most touching?
Well, I thought it was funny when Bill was chasing Juju. Like, it is possible to outpace the 6 to 7 year old even when you're 50, but I kind of did like it when he was chasing her
but
around.
But he's got a foot. Someone's
he's oh, that's right. His foot in it. Oh, that's right. Yeah, sure. Yeah. So, yeah, Bill. But look, when you're looking after someone else's kid, like, you're usually more careful than when you're looking after your own kid. Like, I kept thinking, Bill, it's all in the voice. You know, come on. Bill, be more assertive. But I just love that she threw the water balloon and she's just like, just running around being Juju, you know? She's the best. Anyway, that was
Juju being
Yeah,
that's
my favourite.
Yeah. How about you, Bertha?
Selecting the promotional photos, that was just hilarious. And Ji-Yoon asking if they're hiring him to sell cognac, that was also kind of hilarious. And I just checked. He's never done a cognac commercial.
I'm glad that you know how to check that so clearly.
Yeah. Also that you said I checked with the group before. Like there's you're going to need to know about that too, Bertha.
There's a viral Russian beer ad.
There is, yeah. There was. And I thought what was touching was Ji-Yoon and Yes's conversation, I think, you know, at the end of the episode where she talked about how, you know, she was handed a ticking time bomb so they can ensure a woman was holding it when it explodes. And That speaks so much about, I don't think just academia, in I think, you know, every industry in general, that a woman is expected to come in and solve problems, unsolvable problems, I think, in that sense, yeah.
I did like every scene with Bill and Juju, and I loved them. I think it was Talking Heads that was playing over the top of that track. Mm. So again, really perfect music choice, especially where she's doing his hair and it's really sweet. And I do like in the apology, I don't know if you caught, I didn't catch the line exactly, but something like he reads out Juju's apology and it's like, I now understand that I'm not allowed to bite even if someone asks you to. makes you really wonder exactly what was going on in the playground, actually, because you could really well imagine somehow Juju getting into a situation where someone was inviting her to bite them for some reason. I don't know why. Anyway, okay, best lines. I think I've probably given my best line. So what about you, Megan? What did you think?
I loved when Joan says to Horatio, "It's me," in her incognito in the library. Just thought that was hysterical.
Like he didn't know.
Yeah. And
does anyone remember how she said that line to him in the lecture theatre, you know, where she said jokingly, but she wasn't joking. What was that line?
Something about killing him.
Let's kill him, she said jokingly when she wasn't really joking or something. Yeah. And sorry, Megan, I interrupted you.
That's okay. And the other line was Yaz's when she was talking to Ji-Yoon, "I'm not sure what is okay to say and what's not okay to say." You know, that precarity is always about holding your tongue. You know, maybe Ji-Yoon can't hear what Yaz is actually saying to her when it says it kills me, you know, but where's the action? Where's the refusal, the resistance? How does this align to your mission? And what is Ji-Yoon's mission? That ticking time bomb line is a get out. And it, you know, it's really relevant here. But what is Ji-Yoon's mission here? It's never actually stated.
She never gets a chance.
Yeah, and you do wonder. Yeah. Well, maybe her and Yaz have talked about it a lot in the past before she got to be chair.
Well, she did do a little bit of it when she had her speech when she was high on the staircase. Like, she was trying to lay out a vision. Just got a bit hijacked by Bill again, strangely.
Funny that.
How about you, Anitra?
Everything Joan yelled at that student, all of it injected into my veins. So it wasn't really the line, it was just the vibe. I just loved it. She was just passionate and I thought it's the start of a new career and Joan needs to be on Twitter. You know, it was great.
I think Joan should have her own TikTok channel.
Totally. Apparently old people on TikTok are the thing. Like, that's the funniest thing, apparently, according to my children.
Old people go off on the app. Yeah, apparently. I hear that. How about you, Bertha?
I wrote down three where Ji-Yoon kind of said, "Trust me, I know." And that line I've repeated a lot of times. Joan, when she said, "You don't have to like me," and then a few sentences later, she just says, "Stay the fuck out of my classroom." God, I wish I can say that sometimes. But not to everyone, but, you know, sometimes you do.
Yeah,
you do
just get the odd student.
Yeah,
here
exactly.
And
yeah, but
so we've thought it. Let's all face it.
Yeah. So I love the way she said, you know, she said it, and it was after that whole kind of rant about Chaucer and kind of, yeah, no, that was a really good scene.
I've got another line here. I forgot that I put in the show notes where Elliot's fussing over his ceremonial robes, you know, and he's complaining that they've been adjusted and he's lost a little weight. And then he says, "Look what they did to the sleeves. This isn't bell-shaped. This is oblong. This is a master's gown." I don't know if anyone else has been backstage at graduation where those moments happen where people are like, "This is the wrong hood. Where are my tassels?"
My aunt boss Mary was always the person everyone would line up so that she would get your bobby pins, because those hats are not designed to sit on ladies'
human head.
Had this way with bobby pins, and everyone, there'd just be a line in front of Mary of everyone getting their bobby pins done, and she just make sure everyone looked good before they walked out. Like, it is like being in a show. You have to go and sit on stage and you have to be very serious, and if you're stuck where the camera points at for the whole time, you have to have the appropriate facial expression whenever it cuts to that shot of you. It's terrifying. And so every year that was our goal, was like, please get me in right position in the processional so I'm not sitting in that seat that the camera's going to point at me. So, you know, I'm with Elliot. You need to look good.
In William Clark's Charismatic Origins of the Research University, should be a bestseller. You may not have read it, but anyway, starts off with talking about how academic processionals deeply homoerotic. And that the robes and that the dressing up part of academia is this kind of like undiscussed homoerotic men showing their legs and their calves and their, you know, anyway.
Okay.
Anyway, I digress.
Whereas I actually own my own robe, so I can wear my colour of my university.
Yeah, so do I. Gowntown.com. Cheap robes.
Absolutely.
Out there.
Yeah. And because I actually...
I bought mine in the op shop.
Well, you know, Canberra.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
I work in an Indigenous unit, and my colleagues paint up for the procession. So there's ochre. They wear ochre on their faces. And
brilliant.
And it's fantastic. And we also carry our ceremonial possum skin cloaks in the procession. Indigenous students are allowed to wear Indigenous cloaks. And so we
all, really? In Melbourne Uni, right?
Yes. Well, yeah. In all universities, they should have this.
I've never seen one at ANU, but I'll take your word for it.
Really?
All universities. I'd imagine we wouldn't be against it. No. I just have never seen it in any
Well, we actually always have possum skin cloaks, which is the robes, so that if students, you know, want to wear them, they're actually at the ceremony. And our possum skin cloaks that represents the research unit for Indigenous arts and cultures is actually a knowledge holder within itself. So it's an entity within itself. And, you know, sometimes I actually get to carry that particular robe. So I think it's pretty special.
What an honour. And do they keep it anywhere special in between times? Like, because robes do tend to get, I don't know about you all, but my robe is kind of stuffed in the corner of a cupboard. I'm imagining that I'm hoping the possum robes are treated with a little more care and respect than that.
Well, they're actually on our sofa. We're in our student engagement area.
Really?
Because it's a comfort thing too.
Oh, so they're multifunctional robes.
They're multi, you know, so if you get cold, you know, you can just come and, you know, just if it's allowable in your particular mob to, you know, touch possum, you know, you can come in and just, you know, have a bit of a moment with the possum. But one of the cloaks actually sits within the dean's office. The Ruiak cloak sometimes sits within the dean's office because it's a reminder for them to actually acknowledge Indigenous knowledges within the academy.
It's interesting, isn't it? Like, I mean, that little moment really struck me because I'm just slightly obsessed with sort of academic robes and all that sort of stuff. But sidebar, talking about the possum robe as a sort of comfort or warming object, one of the reasons that we have hoods and robes was the pecking order was how far back you sat from the fire.
Mm.
So if you sat close to the fire, you didn't need a hat or a scarf of any sort, right? If you were the undergraduates, you sat way back and so you had to have hoods and stuff to keep warm, right? So, and interesting fun fact that you'll find out if you read William Clark's Charismatic Origins of the Research University is that the doctoral robe is actually the dressing gown of 18th century German professors who used to teach from their homes. So if you became a doctoral student of a professor, you used to go to their home, you'd eat dinner. Some of them were quite famous for poisoning people and having or being bad cooks.
Maybe I should read this book.
You actually worked from home and you had your students in your home, and therefore the robe is actually like a dressing gown. How good is that?
All I can say these days is that the long sleeve things are perfect for putting your cell phone into before you go up on the stage if you don't have a pocket.
You can certainly hold things in
those
sleeves.
Yeah, they're very
handy.
Sure.
That's right.
Or snacks.
So this has been a good segue into our last section, which is the most important one about costumes. So which one was your favourite and why, Megan?
Well, as Paris Summer plays from 1972, Joan glides out of the lift in her tan incognito number with sunglasses, tan burgundy scarf. And I couldn't work out whether or not it was 1972 or 1986, you know, was her moment.
Yeah.
I want the sunglasses, and I normally hate tan, like I hate Bill. But, you know, it's not one of those colours I normally wear, but Joan can just pull it off that tan.
Yeah.
It takes a special colouring to pull off tan. Anitra, how about you?
You said you'd give me the Joy Division T-shirt, so I'm taking it. Mm-hmm. What's wrong with me? That's all I'm going to say.
How about you, Bertha?
I miss winter. You know, I moved back to Malaysia 6 years ago now. God. Time flies. I lived in England for close to 20 years, so I miss winter, and I have a thing for coats, and I still have a huge collection of coats back in the UK. So Jean's kind of light grey coat is my fave, and it's something that, you know, I would like to have in my wardrobe if possible.
Is there ever a time you can wear a coat? Because I love coats too. That would be like never.
Not
like
in Malaysia. Cold enough. No, no. It's like 365 days of tropical weather. And wow. Humid.
What about if you go to a movie theater and it's like really over air conditioned? Can you take a coat for that?
No.
Well, still it's dark, isn't no. it? There's no real point in that, is there? Mm. Yeah. No. We feel your sadness.
You just have to let it go. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Well, when I
come
back
and visit
to London.
Me in Canberra.
And take my
Are
coat.
You planning to go back to London?
Yeah, when the borders are open, I'd love to be back.
How about you, Narelle? What was your favourite outfit?
Yeah, I really liked the scene in the kitchen after the opening titles with the popped collar. I just love it when she pops the collar on jackets. It's just, she just does it so well.
Yeah, I think I picked the same one. It was like that orange sweater and a tan blazer and it had elbow patches and it was just perfection. But also a big shout out for Yaz when she encounters Elliot at the photocopy. I actually think that's the most perfect outfit on her. She's got her afro going and she's got a beautiful, that beautiful blue leather jacket that she's got and it's sort of snugly fitted. It's very sexy in a kind of appropriate for work kind of way, but she's very striking in that. I think it's a beautiful outfit. All right. So that's all our thoughts and feelings about episode 4. But what about you? This is our correspondence section where we read out feedback about our episodes or our correspondence. But first of all, a big shout out to our beautiful friend Nick Hill in London, who sent me a text today saying, by the way, I've listened to both episodes of your new podcast. I really enjoyed it. It's very amusing and interesting, even though I obviously haven't seen the show that you're discussing. he does love Anitra's analysis of the graphics and your chat about the clothes, and it's so nice to hear you. So, Nick, we miss you too.
We do.
And thank you for listening, even though you haven't actually watched the show, which is very funny. That's true friendship. On the Twitters, Carolyn Leslie gave us a fabulous lesson and breakdown in the Theory Boys in Literature, which was a shout-out we did in last episode. There was a line, what was it, the line, there's always some theory boy talking about Lacan. Yeah. Anitra, I think you did a shout-out asking people to decode that one for us, and we did get contributions from our friends Chin Koo and Catherine Firth, who are also not literature academics but literature adjacent, I suppose. And we thought we'd actually act out this Twitter thread, which could be fun. So I think, Narelle, you were going to play Carolyn Leslie. Who was playing Chin?
I'm playing Chin.
I think that Megan. And Anitra, you're playing yourself?
Yes, I will play myself.
In this Twitter thread? Okay.
Yeah.
Right, take it away, Narelle.
Can't wait for the next ep. Love the pod. Think it's hilarious that eps are two times the length of individual shows.
It's true.
Sure.
Maybe, though, forget about recruiting film studies academics. Find someone from the English department. That line read, theory boys, Lacan, a snort worthy plus true English deep cut.
I was totally on board for that burn. Theory boys in lit studies, def a thing.
I snorted my drink out my nose. Lacan was a cherry on the top.
Okay, I'm going to need a full explanation.
Can we explain this in a tweet, Jean? Or does it need a full thesis? Let's have a go. A, it's referencing English literary studies, which B, at times have been heavily influenced by French theorists, Lacan, Foucault, etc., and which C, a certain style of theory-loving student, often like that guy in your MFA, will dominate discussions. Lacan is a cherry on top because this makes the theory boy's theory god a dated one. Lacan is not irrelevant today, but a de rigueur in the 1990s.
I'm going to step in and play Catherine Firth now.
Yeah.
Yep. Catherine said, this is an A-plus tweet comms. Yep, English in the 1990s here. Foucault for your average theory boy. Lacan, if you wanted to go up a level, got replaced by Foucaultism and then by posthumanism and maybe the other way around. Pretty sure they are all decolonising these days.
And Chin steps in here and says, let's not forget Deleuze and Guattari fanboys. And, of course, those who quote Zizek today bring with them a whole other set of connotations.
Isn't he a communist or something?
And Catherine Firth finishes off with emoji laugh cries. So every time you wonder, why do I stay on Twitter? Moments like that happen. You go, oh, that's why.
Can I just say that, you know, as someone who did English Lit in the 1990s, I can attest to all these kind of, you know, love for dead Frenchmen. And I went to, when I went for my MA in the UK, Zizek was like the thing that everyone had to read. And
God, I think I'm confusing him with someone else. Is he a communist? I thought he was a communist.
Well, we often say he's one of the first academics who really celebrated himself. I don't think you can actually call him a communist in that way. Like he loves being on TV. He's probably one of the most kind of postmodernist, post-structuralist philosopher. And he can churn out a book in like 4 months because he writes a lot. Like he writes a lot of commentary for you know, kind of newspapers and all that. There's a particular subset of cultural theorists who love his work. I think his work is problematic, but yeah, I'm not going to get sidetracked by kind of, you know.
I'm clearly mixing him up with somebody else and I don't know who that is even, but like not an English Lit major. Thanks, Bertha.
Megan, you've got another tweet to read. Well, we're not going to read it out this time, but it was a thread. But do tell us about it.
Martin Emo at Martin Thomas Emo likened listening to the podcast as overhearing a bunch of friends at the next table. And if only we could be at a cafe, and as we're all still pretty much in lockdown and the cafe culture in Melbourne and Canberra really feeling it. If we were at a cafe, this is the type of things we actually talk about. And Martin also suggests that we could be a bit tipsy. And I'd hate to tell you this, Martin, but we like this without alcohol.
Yeah, there's no alcohol.
And as normal, Megan enabled Inga to online clothes purchases after the last episode with a link in the Riverside chat. So other than we normally do that by Twitter DM. So everything is just like normal. Megan enables the academic fashion.
Totally does. And yeah, that's spread, by the way. So you really should get a bit of lead generation from that particular designer. Great find. Okay. Right. Well, we've come to the end of our time on episode 4. So thanks for listening. Like we said, we're 4 white female academics in Australia. Luckily enough to be joined by Bertha from Malaysia today. These are our reactions and we're interested in yours. So you can email us on the address in the show notes. You can leave a review on Apple Podcasts and we should read some of those out next week. And you can also rate us there and that makes the pod easier to find. If you want to join us to ask us a question by voice, the best way to do that is via speakpipe.com and the address is in the show notes. We'd love to hear from you. Now, where can we people find you on the web, Megan?
I'm at Megan J. McPherson on Insta and Twitter and that's where you'll meet my academic cats, Maximum, Dulcie and Mr. Finn.
Narelle, how about you?
You can find me at Rally Pops on Twitter and Instagram, and also I blog at www.exploreandcreateco.com.
Thanks, Narelle and Anitra.
I'm at AnitraNot on all the things, especially Pinterest. Just putting it out there. That's my most successful one. And you can find all about me on AnitraLand.com.
And finally, Bertha.
I'm Bertha_C on Twitter and on Instagram, I'm Transcultural Fangirl.
Thanks, everyone. I'm Thesis Whisperer on Twitter and Thesis Whisperer in Google. Will find me on many places. Thanks, friends.
Thank you.
and thank you all for listening. We'll see you next week.